This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Okay. Let me begin. My name is Leon Wiener Dow. I have to use the microphone because this is being recorded. Otherwise, this would be the first thing that I would ditch. The texts are probably going to be the second thing I'll ditch. Let me say something. I'll start with an apology. I'm not teaching you've been deceived. You've been duped. Unless you came to hear me, which probably none of you did, you probably came on the basis of the title, and I've changed the title. Let me tell you about the title that was, and let me tell you about the title that is. The title that was, you'll read it, something about loving oppression, yeah? The joy of oppression. And originally I thought that that's what I was going to teach about because I've been bothered for a number of years, and I'm increasingly bothered by the fact that I think that we Jews have become somewhat obsessed with and in love with our status as being oppressed. But what I found myself thinking about since the time that I had to give in the title and the time that I actually had to turn in the sources is how do we qualify something as chorban? And the truth is that that's been something, maybe it's my age, maybe it's the year I've been going through. I've been thinking a lot about how it is that we classify something that happened to us as bad, or for that matter, as good. What is it about the destruction of the temple that makes it clear that it was bad? Because as I told my son this morning, actually, I'm not too keen on having another temple. Maybe I'm not supposed to say that, but it's true. Not only does it not interest me, I think that Judaism made enormous strides forward with the destruction of the temple. I don't mean to deny the reality of the pain and the sense of shatteredness and loss and religious misorientation, disorientation that resulted from the destruction. But I think overall, in retrospect, something very, very deeply good happened as a result of that. I might even say something positive happened. An overall, if I had to, you know, I forget who it was who says, you know, is it good for the people, or the bad, good for the Jewish people, or bad for the Jewish people? Woody Allen, close call. So, you know, good for the Jewish people, bad for the Jewish people, destruction of the temple. I'd probably say good for the Jewish people overall, long term. So what interests me is how we describe something as chorban. So while I pass out the papers, I'm going to start by telling you a story.
For the latecomers, there are more in the back.
So I didn't tell you anything biographical about myself. Mainly just because I didn't want to spend time doing it, but I'm originally from Houston, Texas. It's been a long time because I've been in Israel since 1992, and I did a master's in Jewish philosophy and then studied for rabbinic ordination from Rabbi David Hartman of blessed memory, and then I did a doctorate in philosophy at Bar-Ilan University, and I'm research fellow at the Hartman Institute, and I teach at Bina, the secular yeshiva in Tel Aviv. So Rabbi Hartman used to tell this story, and he wrote about it, I think, in the introduction to A Heart of Many Rooms, I think is when he wrote it. So he used to tell the story about when he was a congregational rabbi in Montreal, and he had been here right after the Six-Day War. And he went back to his congregation in Montreal, And Erev Tisha B'Av, just as everyone is, all of his congregants are sitting on the floor, lighting candles, the parochet, you know, the ark is covered in black. Everyone's, you know, got somber faces. No one's smiling. No one's greeting each other. And Rabbi Hartman got up and he says, I just want to tell, did anyone in the room ever hear Rabbi Hartman speak? Okay, so this is the way. I just want to tell you, I just want to tell you that right now, people are dancing in the streets of Yerushalayim. And then he sat down. For him, it was maddening, the idea that somehow we're continuing this ritual of mourning, even though something fundamental has changed, and we're continuing as if nothing has happened. And then he would tell the story, or he writes about it, that he went to his Rav Soloveitchik, after 67, and he says, you have to declare a holiday. You have to, something enormous has happened to us as a people. You have to note it. You have to say something. We have to, somehow our ritual has to change. Our consciousness has to change. And Rabbi Soloveitchik said, quoted from the Gemara in Shabbat, which discusses Hanukkah and the decision of the rabbis to declare it a holiday. And he says, and Rabbi Soloveitchik quoted the Gemara, which says, Lishna Cheret, they waited a year before they declared it a miracle. So I was discussing this last night at our Seudah Mafseket, and it's not a year, right? Soloveitchik's claim, quoting the Gemara, was, you need time. You need a sense of historical perspective in order to be able to declare something as good or bad. Right? How many things have happened in our lives? And this is going to be a basic, I'm not sure there are too many axioms in what I have to teach today, but this is a basic axiom. Basic axiom that I have is that there's no distinction to be made between our ability or inability, for that matter, to declare something as good or bad at a personal level or at a national level or at a collective level. It's the same fundamental human existential difficulty, religious difficulty, whatever you want to call it. It's the same. It doesn't matter whether it's, I got divorced, oh, that was painful. Maybe it's a good thing, actually. I met the person I fell in love with, I'm on cloud nine. Actually, maybe it's going to end up horribly. Maybe it was the worst thing. Maybe I married that person and there were really significant parts of my personality that I had to jettison and will never play themselves out. And in a deep way, that's a real loss. And the same thing is true at the national level. Exact same thing. Something that can appear at one time as a good thing and end up being a very bad thing, and the opposite is the case. Right, so Rabbi Soloveitchik said to Rabbi Hartman, the wisdom of the Chachamim, of the rabbis in the Gemara and Shabbat, is that they said, whoa. It's what Hartman used to call halachic sobriety. That was a term that he used. Right? Don't get so carried away. Don't get so excited. Be sober. Religiously speaking, be sober. Look at events. Ruminate. Chew on them, as my grandfather used to say. Give every tooth a chance. Chew on them slowly, right? And then try to make some judgment. So that's the background. The title of the session is Chorban, Vicissitudes, and Redemption, Geula. What interests me is how, and so we have Chorban at one end. What allows us to call something, to label it a chorban, destruction, or catastrophe. I'll just use the term chorban, I think. And then there's most of what we have, which is vicissitudes. The back and forth of history, the back and forth of our lives. The things that look good and then suddenly turn bad. Or they look good and they are good, but they also have some bad stuff in them. And vice versa. And then there's geula. There's redemption, which, so I did my doctorate on Franz Rosenzweig, whose main book is called, I mean, it's really the only book he wrote. It's called The Star of Redemption. So I should have spent a lot of time thinking about redemption. I mean, I guess I kind of have if you charted up the hours, but I don't think I really understand much about it. I'm not sure I understand what the term means. So I want to, but I do think that it's probably the opposite of what Chorban is. Whatever Geula, whatever redemption is categorically, religiously, I think that it's probably the opposite of Geula. So I want to suggest at the end, this is just going to be at the tail end, maybe by then it'll be time for Mincha or something, so I'll have an excuse of being positive, which I try not to be ever, but certainly not on Tisha B'Av. So just at the tail end, I'll say something about Geula, about redemption, because I think that actually there's a lot at stake in terms of understanding everything up until we get to that point in our shiur. I think that there's a lot at stake, how should I say it? We understand what everything else is by our ability to say what Geula is. Okay, so let's. Vicissitudes are the back and forth. You usually speak about the vicissitudes of history, things that go back and forth. And so I'm actually, you could also talk about the vicissitudes of consciousness, right? And actually part of what I'm saying, which is not just me, I think we'll see in just a minute, it's the Mishnah, is saying, is that the same thing, the actual one event could itself in itself contained vicissitudes. It can go back and forth. The same event itself can take you back and forth. And that's part of, right, that's what Rabbi Hartman used to talk about. That's part of what he, when he was quoting Soloveitchik, I mean, that was what was great about being a Jew outside of history before Zionism. I mean, after exile, you know, after the destruction of the temple and before Zionism, when Jews were so-called out of history, which of course we never were, but metaphorically speaking, when we were out of history, the good thing was we were just total losers all the time. And so we didn't, no, I'm being serious. And so we didn't, you know, someone wants to convert. And so what do you say? Would you like to join the losers club? You know, would you like to come and suffer with us? Please join us, right? So that was our, I mean, that's get back to the class that I'm not teaching, but that gets back to our consciousness of ourself as oppressed and of constantly being chased and run over and run out of town, right? Let's start with text number one, which ended up being very central to what we're going to do today. This is a very, very small snippet from a book by Alan Mintz called Chorban, Responses to Catastrophe in Hebrew Literature. Catastrophe in Jewish tradition is best understood not in terms of physical and material devastation. I'm going to substitute the word Chorban for catastrophe because I think that's what he means. A destructive event becomes a Chorban when it convulses or vitiates shared assumptions about the destiny of the Jewish people in the world. In pre-modern times, this means specifically the terms of the covenant between God and Israel. The responses to Chorban in Hebrew literature involve attempts first to represent the Chorban and then to reconstruct, replace, or redraw the threatened paradigm of meaning and thereby make creative survival possible. So this is interesting to me. Mintz says that what allows something to enter into the category of Chorban, it doesn't matter how many people were killed or how many buildings were destroyed or how central the buildings were to our national or religious framework. The question, and it applies for the Shoah no less, what was different? I mean, there is, an answer to be given for the Shoah. I've never quite understood. I mean, I spent a number of years, I was kind of obsessed with the Shoah, but I never, even when I, my obsessed years, I never understood what people thought was so fundamentally different. Because it was 6 million? Oh. Well, no, I mean, the problem is basically the same, right? I mean, if you quote the Mishnah in Sanhedrin, one person's killed, It's an entire world. So why is it suddenly, you know, 100,000 now, oh, that changes everything for me. 200,000, that changed, 6 million. I think, according to Mintz's definition, the only argument to be made about why the Shoah or any other event would constitute a Chorban is because it no longer allows us to think in the same paradigm. As this is like Thomas Kuhn, right? The idea that somehow scientific revolutions take place when something now, we have enough events that no longer fit into the framework of thinking that is dominant, that is regnant for us. If we think of things in a certain way, we think that we have a covenant with God. And if something happens, and we can call it Yisurei Hava, we can say, oh, God's doing this, he's making us suffer because God really loves us. So as long as that explanation still works, it's not going to be Chorban. It's going to be Chorban when somehow we're going to have to come up with a new explanation because it's no longer working. That's when it becomes a paradigm-shifting event. That's when we have to now rethink everything. Someone in our relationship, someone does something, and now everything has to be rethought. You did this to me? Right? We've all experienced that, I hope not too often, and I hope not with too many people or with too intimate relationships, where someone does something, and now you go back in the movie, you rewind the whole movie, and you say, all these things, I now have to rethink them all, fundamentally. My understanding of you as a person, my understanding of our relationship, my understanding of the world has now fundamentally been altered. I can no longer continue to be in this relationship or experience the world in the same way because something fundamental has changed. That, Min says, that's what Chorban is. Right? The reason, he says, the reason that the destruction of the temple is categorized as Chorban Jewishly is because it caused us to rethink the relationship between God and Israel. Questions or comments at this point before we roll up our sleeves? This was all just a prelude.
Jake. The parallel also that we couldn't trust the non-Jews in the world before that. We could sort of, and like the relationship.
Good. I think that the Shoah is a I think that it is a paradigm shifter. I think that the Shoah was a Chorban, not because of the number of people killed, but because we had, since Enlightenment, a certain understanding about what it meant for progress to occur and what it meant for Jews to integrate and assimilate into Western society. And the Shoah was a Chorban, I think. I mean, this is a discussion to have, not a throwaway comment like I'm making it, but I think that the Shoah enters into that category because it calls into question our ability to maintain that paradigm. That's really the question. Yeah.
How do we know whether the terms of government have changed? Is there
sort of specific rubric used? So I just this morning, that question was, how do we know when the terms of the covenant have changed? Well. So the terms of the covenant are written down, so theoretically they're not supposed to change. The question is whether we have to reevaluate our existing understanding of the terms of the covenant. And my best answer is, I will quote U.S. Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart, who, referring to pornography, said, "I don't know how to define it, but I know it when I see it." So I think that we know that something has changed unalterably, not because we have some a priori definition of what the understanding, but somehow because we are no longer able to function in the paradigm or in the covenant as we understood it. So if we understand that God promised Jewish rule in a Davidic dynasty in the land of Israel, and now we see that the Jews have been exiled and the temple has been destroyed, we can spend an enormous amount of effort tweaking or reinterpreting our understanding of different terms of the covenant, right? But that's going to be a crisis moment, I think a Chorban moment. Okay, let's move on. We are in text number 2. The Mishnah Brachot. Mevorech al ra'a me'ein ha'tova, ve'al ha'tova me'ein ra'a. Ha'tzo'ek l'she'avar, harei zot filat shav. Bless upon the bad which contains good, and upon the good which contains bad. He who prays over what has already happened, this prayer is in vain. That's the Mishnah. So, you're supposed to bless on something bad that happens to you because in it is good.
The Hebrew seems to be different than English.
Yeah, so... Yeah, Hatzoek Leshavar is someone who pleads for something that already, you're right, something who pleads for already, that something that already went past. Actually, Hanoch Albeck's understanding of this Mishnah, for all that it's worth, is that all three of these clauses, Mevarech al ra'a me'ein ha'tova, v'al ha'tova me'ein ra'a, v'hatzoek Leshavar, all three of those are tefilot shav, but we won't go in there right now. I think that what we have here, I mean, I'm not going to spend any time on Hatzoek Leshavar, the person who prays or screams or cries out, that's the best term, for what has already happened. I'm not going to spend any time on that, although maybe I need to because they're obviously related. But the idea is that you're somehow something which you want to categorize as good, you're also somehow expected to have in your religious consciousness, or I don't want to say religious. These texts are all religious, okay? So I don't have to say that anymore. You're supposed to have in your consciousness the fact that something that you experience as bad also contains within it good. I just thought of a friend of mine who was diagnosed with brain cancer. And recently went for, got radiation and then went for a CT. And they're still there. So I don't know how I'm supposed to make sense of that. Right, that's what the Mishnah is saying. You're supposed to somehow see in that something that is bad, also good. It's there. Okay, so... Okay, so maybe the suggestion is maybe you don't need to see it, trust. Good. So, here's the only thing. I think that as responsible readers of Talmud or of the rabbis, we have to distinguish between different historical layers. Okay, so we're about to see something in the Talmud that I think, well, we'll have to ask what both of them mean, but I don't think they're saying the same thing. So the suggestion is, maybe you don't have to see it, maybe you have to trust it. I'm not sure that's much easier. You're right that at that time we surely can't see it. At that time, what's demanded of us by this Mishnah, I think, is what we might call religious imagination or existential imagination. You have to experience something at this moment. You are clearly experiencing it as bad, and you are... The commandment, I think, and it's an injunction, right? It's commanded. You are commanded to somehow be aware, hold an awareness of the fact that it contains something else in it. It's a very, very high standard. That's what I can say. Okay, so let's look at the Gemara. Hey Chidami, the Gemara asks. Okay, so give an example. Kegon. The Shagal Bedaka Be'ara, Afal Gav, the Tavahi Ledide, the Maska Ara, Shilton Veshiv Chahashta, Miha Rahi. So the Gemara says, what's an example of that? So the example that the Gemara gives is a dam was breached and your field is flooded. And even though eventually the flooding is going to leave behind a rich sediment, right now, this is a disaster. Right? I'm from Houston, I told you. We take flooding seriously. Seriously. I'm sorry? I know, but I still have parents and two brothers who live there, and they got off scot-free with Hurricane Harvey, but I have two cousins whose home were damaged, right? So right now you're supposed to say, oh, now this is what's interesting. So I think that what the, well, let's read the next one, right? But what it's saying is, at the end, miha rahi, hashta miha rahi. Right now, however, it's bad. And we're going to see something similar in the next one. Hechidami, kagon de ashkach metzia, afal gav de ra'ahi le didei, de ishema ba malka, shakil lamine, hashtami tovahi. So if you find some object worth a lot of money, it may well be the case that when you walk through Israeli customs, they're going to take 300% of the value of that thing, right? They weren't talking about Israeli customs, they were talking about the non-Jewish person in charge, because it's easier to blame the goy, right? But then you're going to have it taken from you, or you're going to be fined or whatever, and so it's going to be a bad thing. But right now, it's a good thing. So what interests me about the Gemara, which I think is probably in contrast to the Mishnah, is that there's a certain place in which we are being given space to experience the event as it is for us in the present. Right now, this is bad. Hashta mi mia rahi. Right now, this is bad for me. It might be that this contains the seeds of something good. But right now, this is bad. So what I would say, my takeaway from this text is that if we combine it with the Mishnah I think is taking a very, is setting a very, very high bar in saying that something happens and you need to have a consciousness. Even if you can't see it, you need to have either a consciousness or an acceptance of the fact that that same event contains within its folds the exact opposite of what you're experiencing right now. And when you give a bracha on that event, right? And this is what the Gemara is saying. When you give a bracha on that event, right now what you're giving a bracha is on the ra, on the bad thing that happened. This is from God. And in a certain sense, right, like every bracha, it's a kind of consciousness razor. That's what I'm doing right now. Razor night, not R-A-Z-O-R, like lifting up, R-A-I-S-E-R, right? Something happens and I am now elevating it into the consciousness and putting it into the category of bad, or I'm putting it into the category of good, even though in the recesses of my awareness, I'm aware, I have within that an understanding that same event has some other consequences which are waiting to emerge from it. That's very, very hard to hold and not lose your sanity, or not lose your disconnect, and not become disconnected from your experience of what this event is right now. Yeah.
Is that always 100% of the time, or is it just the potential that something might come out of it? Because if it's something that's always going to be coming good out of it, you always stop to pause and say,
right.
What's going to happen?
So the question is it always? Is this Mishnah, is every single event going to, and I think that the answer is yes. I think that the Mishnah is born of an awareness that every single event, we live in a world that is, right, the Maharshal asks, why is it, you may know that anyone who wanted to be a dayan, a shofet of the Sanhedrin, had to be able to letaher et asheretz b'mem ted drachim. He had to be able to give 49 different explanations of how the sheretz, an unclean animal, actually was pure. And so the Maharshal says that was not just intellectual, it's not just to prove his intellectual acumen. I had a professor in college, Victor Preller. I remember that before I would ask my question, I had the sense that he had actually answered it. By the time I finished it, he had already dissected it from 50 different angles and then could give me any one of those 50 answers he had, right? It wasn't that. That's what the Maharshal said. The Maharshal says the reason that member of the Sanhedrin has to be able to give you memtet, 49 different ways of understanding the cleanliness of a sheretz, is because every single thing in this world has aspects of tum'ah and tehara in it. Every single thing in this world. We really want to consider something in this world as good. Something happens to us and we want to say it was good. Nothing is ever 100% good. Remember that when we get to Geula. Right? But when we experience something, right? We experience it fundamentally as, and we have this need, right? You don't have to have listened to the pleading of Steve Jobs in his Connect the Dots speech, or read Kahneman, who talks about how, you know, we create narratives for ourselves, and we put things into the narrative, right? Something happens to us and we have to, whoop, categorize it. It was a good thing, right? It was a bad thing, and that's how we construct a narrative, right? And that is part of what it is to live a sane life, is our ability to construct narratives, right? So I think what the Mishnah is saying is that it contains everything. It contains both aspects. There's nothing that contains only one. Any other comments or questions at this point? Yes?
Yeah, the fact that there may be good and something bad is not important. Something bad can be very, very bad. And the good, you're squeezing good out of it.
Good. Right. So you are demanding what in political terms is called proportionality, right? You're saying I ought to be able to categorize an event as overall good or overall, if it's 95% good, 98% good. Okay, of course everything is complex, right? So all I can say is I've been depressed about the situation in Israel for a while, so nothing, there was no paradigm shift for me this week. But I definitely, as someone who is, I think probably as a lot of people in this room, not everyone, I've staked my life on the future of Israel. Moved from the United States, set roots here, have 5 children. I have a wife too. I just mean like I did. She's my present, not my right planting my future. And I have deep doubts about something as to it's at some point. At what point does that little 1% start to get more and more to the point where now it's threatening what category I'm putting something into? It can happen. That's part of what happens with the vicissitudes of history, is things change. And something that we categorized as good can slowly, slowly, slowly seep and seep and seep to a place where that no longer functions anymore. That's really, getting back to Mintz's claim, that's what Chorban is. When that category that we had for it, we labeled it good. And of course, we know, again, from, you know, Kahneman and Dan Ariely and others, right? We have this ability, once we purchase something, we convince that it's a good thing, and so we tell ourselves a certain story, and we continue to say, oh, it's a good thing. I love what I bought, right? It's the best of the possibilities that I had, right? And then at some point, something smacks you across the face. It says, no, you were telling yourself a story. You were saying it was 98% and 2% bad. And no, you didn't realize. And that's the moment of Chorban. But you're right, for a long time we're not there. for a long time, we want to be able to work with that definition of yes, it's good or yes, it's bad. Yeah.
I think
that the mission is working under the assumption that no matter what happens, when it says mevorech al ra'ah, you're blessing it in the sense of this is God's will. So but what's interesting, I think, is that this is God's will, that sense of bracha, this is God's will, doesn't prevent me from categorizing something as bad. That is to say, the idea, you know, the Voltaire or the Jewish version of Hakol LeTova, you know, that's not what the Mishnah is about. You can say this is from God and it sucks. I have a friend, you know, who when I would ask him how he is, I mean, it's not that he's still alive, he just doesn't live in Israel anymore. But he used to say, Baruch Hashem, terrible. Right? Meaning like he's aware of the fact that, but his situation right now is terrible. That's from God. That was his, you know, that was his proclamation or his declaration or his desire to kind of contain that consciousness. But that's important, less interestingly because of the Baruch Hashem part or the blessing part, but more that blessing or that Baruch Hashem does not obfuscate my clarity that what is happening for me right now is bad. I think that's a very significant religious moment. It is not prevented. We are not prevented. I don't want to claim, you know, oh great, how great. I think that there's something very Jewish about our ability to argue with God, and to say no, this is horrible, this is bad. It's from God and it's bad, and we take issue with certain things. And just because it's from God doesn't mean that we're going to be submissive or acceptive of it. Okay, so I'm going to skip over the next text. And we are going to go to text number 3. But we're going to join it way towards its end, even though it's a really, really good text. Okay, we are on, I guess the, if these had page numbers, it would be page 3. The left side of the page has a little squiggly about halfway down that says, apropos tribulations of exile and hope for redemption. You see where we are? Okay. So I'll start reading there, and I guess I have to read it also because I'm like being recorded. So the listeners, the millions of listeners out there, if I don't read it, won't be able to know what I'm talking about. Okay, so I'm going to start in the Hebrew on the right side. It's probably about 15 lines down. The line begins, Kachilat Kishuin V'Diluin. וכבר היה רבן גמליאל ורבי אלעזר בן עזריה ורבי יהושע ורבי עקיבא מהלכים בדרך. Right, so Rabbi Akiva, רבן גמליאל and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah and Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Akiva are walking along the way. I think that's significant. I won't pause too much during the course of the reading, but I just want to say that I think that it's always interesting and significant when the rabbis find themselves outside of the Beit Midrash. There's a certain kind of learning that takes place when you're not in the Beit Midrash. You could have talked about ideas and suddenly you're out there and boom, there is reality confronting you. So you can talk about Geula, and you can talk about Chorban, and you can talk about a lot of categories, and then you leave Pardes, and you say, what the hell was I thinking? What the hell was he saying? That was nonsense. How do I know it was nonsense? Because here is reality slapping me in the face. Okay, so I'm going to keep reading. וכבר היה רב גמליאל ורבי אלעזר בן עזר ורבי יהושע ורבי עקיבא מהלכים בדרך ושמעו כל המונה של רומי מפלטה ברחוק 120 מיל והתחילו בוכין ורבי עקיבא משחק אמרו לו מפני מה אתה משחק אמר להם ואתם מפני מה אתם בוכים אמרו לו, הללו קושיים שמשתחווים לעצבים ומקטרים לעבודת כוכבים, יושבים בטח והשקט. ואנו, בית אדום רגלי אלוהינו, שרוף באש ולא נבכה? אמר להן, לכך אני מצחק. ומה לעוברי רצונו, כך לעושי רצונו על אחת כמה וכמה. And so was there, רבן גמליאל, רבי אלעזר בן עזריה, רבי יהושע, and רבי עקיבא were walking along the road. And they heard the sounds of the multitudes of Rome from Puteoli at a distance of 120 mil. Right? So there is an enormous, enormous Roman city making so much noise. It's New York City. It's, I don't know what, London. It's the enormous, it's Shanghai. It's this enormous city. It's so enormous that you can't see the stars in the sky because of the lights, and you hear it from so far away. And the sages began weeping, and Rabbi Akiva begins laughing. And so they say to him, why are you laughing? So he does what all Jews do, which is to answer with a question, right? Why am I laughing? Why are you crying? They said to him, these Gentiles who bow to false gods and burn incense to idols dwell securely and tranquilly in the colossal city. And for us, the house of the footstool of our God, the temple is burnt by fire. And shall we not weep? Rabbi Akiva said to them, that's why I'm laughing. If for those who violate his will, the wicked, it is so, and they are rewarded for the few good deeds they are performed. For those who perform his will, all the more so they will be rewarded. Rabbi Akiva says, I mean, this is, first of all, let's just notice another thing, right? If you know Chaim Nachman Bialik's beautiful, I don't know what to call it, essay, Gilui V'Kisui B'Lashon, revealed and disclosed in language. So at the end, he talks, after he's talked about the magnificence of language and the way in which language can, you know, kind of like a word can, like the phoenix, rise again and have new, be bestowed with new meaning. So he says, but there are three things that go beyond that. The nigun, tzchok, vebechi. Laughter, crying, and the nigun. They get somewhere that language doesn't go. Right? And all of us know that. We know it from singing, nigunim. And we know it from when we laugh and when we cry. So it's interesting that the rabbis, they're outside of the Beit Midrash, and they get to, I think, the limits of language as well. The rabbis start crying, and Rabbi Akiva starts laughing. It's this beautiful moment, right? And each one of them thinks that the other one's crazy. You've totally lost touch with reality. How could you be laughing right now? And Rabbi Akiva, I think he's being serious. I don't think he's being disingenuous or sarcastic. He's saying to them, I don't understand what you're crying about. Are you lunatics? What are you looking at that's sad for you? Because for me, there's something that actually makes me laugh. I think that's Rabbi Akiva's genuine experience. The only problem is that Rabbi Akiva, I mean, what I would say is, he's, you know, if we were walking with him, we'd say he's off his rocker. right? He's after a religious consciousness that is able to, and this gets back to our word, withstand the vicissitudes of the world. Right now, things are horrible. And Rabbi Akiva has this ability, which is a blessing and a curse, right? With like all the things we've been talking about today, it's a blessing and a curse. He has the ability to not be fazed whatsoever by the bitterness of the reality that he's experiencing. Not only is he not fazed by it, it's actually sweet for him. I think it's genuinely sweet for him. He thinks, wow, this is fantastic.
Are you based that also on his end, that in the end he's killed by the Romans, and he says that my opportunity to...
Okay, great. Good, I had not thought of that connection. That's an interesting idea, right? That might be... I mean, I'm thinking of any Life of Brian fans. Okay, so there's that moment when he's being crucified and singing Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. It might be, I think that surely they're connected, right?
If you're going to connect it with Rabbi Akiva's rest of his life, connected to the rebellion of Beitar and Bar Kokhba, which made the destruction not last for 70 years, but 2,000 years.
Great. Say more. So what about that? What do you want?
He's marching to the beat of a different drummer and not necessarily
good.
In a positive sense.
That's right. I personally don't think that it's in a positive sense at all. I think that Rabbi Akiva, how should I say it? Mashal ma davar domeh, right? We know of Rabbi Eliezer, right? Rabbi Eliezer is the one who says to his Talmidim, Shuv yom echad lifnei mitatcha, right? Do tshuva one day before you die. And so his students in Pirkei, that he says in the Mishnah, right, in Avot. And his students say in Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, v'chiyodea adam matay yamut, does a person know when he's going to die? And Rabbi Eliezer answers, yaseh tshuva shem yamut machar. So you do tshuva today, lest you die tomorrow. And you do tshuva tomorrow, lest you die the next day. Nimtza kol yamav b'tshuva. And that way, you're all the time doing tshuva. Now that's great, except that most of us cannot live our lives like Rabbi Eliezer. That's why most of us need Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Most of us, when we have someone around us, hopefully it's not us, you know, hopefully it's not our friends, but something horrible happens, right? And then we do an accounting and we say, wait, am I living my life the way I want to be living? Because most of us can't live, and I think that most of us can't live our lives the way Rabbi Akiva does. And probably that's a good thing. Right, Rabbi Akiva, it's the same Rabbi Akiva who would start, when he was doing tefillah, he would start in one corner of the room and end up in the other corner of the room. There was a certain, I would say, you know, dare I say disconnect, I just said it. You know, he's able to experience levels of reality that most of us are not, and that might be a good thing in certain moments. It's certainly a dangerous thing. I think you're right. I think that if I go back to the Mishnah, what I would say is that Rabbi Akiva, in a certain sense, you know, Kasha, a Mishnah al Rabbi Akiva, this is a certain, right, this is a certain Kasha that the Mishnah, which says, Mevrech al Ra'a Meina Tova, right, you're supposed to be able to say, right now, this is bad. Right, if we go back to the Mishnah, the Gemara tells us, right now, your field was flooded, don't curse God, but say, this is bad. This is what it is. Right? And I think that what I considered, what I was claiming then was affirming in terms of our religious consciousness is that the Mishnah says, yes, you experience this as bad, and we're not asking, and the Gemara says, we're not asking you to somehow change your experience of it. We're allowing you to affirm your experience of this thing as bad. And I think that there's something both uplifting and extremely dangerous, comforting and unnerving, and somewhat problematic by Rabbi Akiva's ability to laugh. I agree.
On the national and the personal level.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, go ahead.
I come from a post-Holocaust family. My parents went through the Holocaust, survived. And I grew up in a community in the Netherlands which was all mourning and destruction and ruins. Creators of misery. Mm. And they decided to devote their life to an incredible joy of life and a joy for Judaism. And the atmosphere I grew up was entirely different then the social environment of the Jewish community are developed. And it was a decision they made.
Right. So just this morning, instead of writing something I wanted to write, I found yet another tight way to waste time. So I clicked on an email that a brother of mine sent about another brother of mine. One of my brothers defends people on death row, and he lives in Texas, so he has a lot to do. And just like last week, a client on his birthday, a client of his was executed. I clicked on this video of this client of my brother's. Anthony Davis is his name, he has a name. And the appeal to the Texas Board of Parole for clemency, which actually the victim's son petitioned for the Board of Parole to grant him clemency, was denied. And the reason that the victim's son did it was based on this video that he saw. And he said it maybe three or four times over the course of this video, where he says, he talks about how thankful he is for having been on death row because he was able to transform his life in a way that otherwise he doesn't think he would have been able to. And I just kept thinking, he said, and he even at one point he said, he's African American, he says, it was clear to me, like for me, not me, Leon, right? And so where I grew up, to be in prison is a badge of honor. And it was clear to me that I'd be in prison. Like that's kind of, you know, his term was not pshita, but it was obvious that as an African American who went into gang life and was using alcohol and drugs and crime, he was going to be in prison. The only question was whether he was going to be on death row. And so he says, and I thought I can't be hearing this right, but he says it like three times. By the third time, I was like, I just heard right. He said, it wasn't enough that I was in prison. If not for my being on death row, I wouldn't have tapped into these creative forces that I have in me. So it is definitely the case that it is humanly possible to take a horrible, painful situation and make it transformative. And actually, I would even say, levarech al zeh. To say, I am thankful for the opportunity that I was given to transform myself and to walk around with the consciousness that if this had not happened in this way, I would not be able to be the person that I am. And if you're happy with the person that you are, then you bless on those circumstances, however painful and torturous they were. And that's a remarkable ability that human beings have when we're our highest selves. I want to say something, let's just finish this text, and then I promised you something positive, I don't know. Shuv pam, back in the Hebrew. Shuv pam achat hayu olim lirushalayim, kevan shehigiu lehar tzofim, karu bigdehem. כיוון שהגיעו להר הבית, ראו שועל שיצא מבית קודשי הקדושים, התחילו הן בוכין ורבי עקיבא מצחק. אמרו לו, מפני מה אתה מצחק? אמר להם, מפני מה אתם בוכים? אמרו לו, מקום שכתוב בו, ועזר הקרב יומת, ועכשיו שועלים הלכו בו, ולא נבכה. So on a different occasion, they were going up to Jerusalem, they arrive at Mount Scopus, and they see from there the site of the temple, and they rent their garments, and they see when they arrived at the Temple Mount, they saw a fox that emerged from the Holy of Holies, and they began weeping, right? It's the same old, same old. They start crying, and Rabbi Akiva starts laughing, and he says, why are you laughing? They say, why are you laughing? And he says, why are you crying? And they say, because it was written, no one, not even a non-priest, a Jewish non-priest is supposed to go up to the temple. And now it's foxes, it's animals that are walking around there. Shouldn't we weep? Amar lehen, lekach ani mitzachek. This is why I'm laughing. Dichti va'ida li edim ne'amanim et Uriya Kohen v'tzecharia ben Berachayahu v'chima inyan Uriah Zechariah, Uriah b'Mikdash Rishon v'Zechariah b'Mikdash Sheni. אלא תלה כתוב נבואתו של זכריה בנבואתו של אוריה. So he says, Rabbi Akiva says, this is why I'm laughing. As it is written, when God revealed the future to the prophet Isaiah, and I will take to me faithful witnesses to attest Uriah the priest and Zechariah the son of Yevarchiah. Now what is the connection between Uriah and Zechariah? Uriah prophecy during the first temple, Zechariah in the second. Rather, the verse is that the fulfillment of the prophecy of Zechariah is dependent upon the prophecy fulfillment of the prophecy of Uriah. לכן באוריה כתיב בגללכם ציון שדה תחרש וכולי, עוד בזכריה כתיב ישבו זקנים וזקנות ברחובות ירושלים. עד שלא נתקיימה נבואתו של אוריה, הייתי מתיירא שלא תתקיים נבואתו של זכריה. עכשיו שנתקיימה נבואתו של אוריה, בידוע שנבואתו של זכריה מתקיימת לשון הזה, אמרו לו עקיבא, ניחמתנו, עקיבא ניחמתנו. So he says, in the prophecy of Uriah, it's written, therefore, for your sake, Zion shall be plowed as a field, and Jerusalem shall become rubble, and the Temple Mount as the high places of a forest. There's a rabbinic tradition that this was prophesied by Uriah. In the prophecy of Zechariah, it's written, there shall yet be elderly men and women sitting in the streets of Jerusalem. Until the prophecy of Uriah was fulfilled, I was afraid that the prophecy of Zechariah would not be fulfilled. Now that the prophecy of Uriah was fulfilled, it's evident that the prophecy of Zechariah remains valid. And then the sages say, the oddest of the things, you've comforted us. So Rabbi Akiva is able to say, I consider the nevuah, the prophecy of Zechariah, to be dependent upon the prophecy of Uriah. And so, if I see that that is taking place, then I also know that the prophecy of Zechariah will take place. He's able, and I think this gets to your point, I think that he's able to, it's an uncertainty, which, at least for me, leaves me uncomfortable. Because he's able to say, I see a certain direction of things. He has a paradigm, and he's unfazed, so long as he doesn't have to switch the paradigm. So long as he's still able, let me put it this way, right? If we go back to Asher Mintz's description or definition of Chorban, Akiva doesn't experience this as Chorban. That's the bottom line. The paradigm is still working for him. What's that? So what I would say is that he hasn't, we all have the element of Emunah. What we do is, every single one of us, Rabbi Akiva and the Chachamim are all doing the same thing. An event occurs, and they ask themselves, how do I categorize this event? I need to categorize it, good or bad, Choban, Geulah, I need to put some label on the event. I don't think that the Chachamim have less Emunah than Rabbi Akiva, but for Rabbi Akiva, his paradigm is still working. For him, he says, because I was worried, I was almost worried, but because the Nevuah, the prophecy of Zechariah, is dependent upon the Nevuah of Uriah, I can still function with the same paradigm, and therefore, it doesn't bother me that there are foxes in the Beit Mikdash, because I know that that means that there will be old women and old men in the streets of Jerusalem, because the Torah, the paradigm that I understand the Torah to be presenting me still works. So all I want to say is that this is dependent upon an idea. It's dependent upon maintaining that paradigm, and it's dependent upon having a clear sense of linearity, that history is going in a certain direction, and even though it's here right now, it's going to go there, so long as I'm able to hold that paradigm. Okay? I'm going to call that into question and then finish on a positive note, but first a couple of questions or responses.
That the structure of the temple was
You're saying it does not feel that he felt that way.
That's right. The later one sounds completely different.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that he doesn't experience it that way. Now, there is...
No, I'm saying he did consider a korban. He's prepared to rebel against the Romans.
Right, but it's because... As Mintz is describing it, right? In other words, it's a bad thing. At what point do I say my existing categories no longer work? I think that through this text, Rabbi Akiva's existent categories are still working for him. It's terrible destruction. But Chorban, I'm accepting Mintz's definition. I think that Mintz's definition, according to Mintz's definition, this is not Chorban for Akiva, because he's still able to salvage, he's still able to understand what happened through the categories that he's holding on to. What I would say is, at some point we have to ask ourselves in our individual lives and in our collective lives, am I just holding on to these categories for dear life? Am I reading something as positive or reading something as negative because I'm so stuck, because I need the security of my reading? That's, I think, what usually characterizes most of us. Most of us really need the security of our readings. And so we have to be able to categorize something in that way. And I think going back to the Mishnah, just one second, I think going back to the Mishnah in Brachot, I think that what it's saying is, we allow you to affirm it, but just know that things are very complicated. Just keep it in mind. Right? Yeah. Just very loud, I can't hear. It's morally what? I think that, Hermann Cohen, the philosopher, German Jewish philosopher, said about Zionism, he said he was anti-Zionist. And he said the Zionists, they just want to enjoy themselves. That was a bad thing. Right? He would not be moved or impressed by, whatever that index is, that shows that Israelis, have a zest for life and enjoy their lives or something like that. That would be an indication of failure. I think that laughter is, generally speaking, from the time that Sarah laughs and Abraham laughs, actually, since Sarah's the only one who gets in trouble, but that's presumably because it was man who wrote the text, because Abraham was laughing too. It's not considered a good thing at that time, right? You're not supposed to pray from a place of laughter. You're supposed to be serious. We're supposed to be very serious, But I think that Rabbi Akiva's laughter is an indication of just being unfazed. Right, I think that he's being presented to us as in this text as a hero for laughing. He does. I would even say it's a form of resistance. Akiva doesn't take up arms. Bar Kokhba does. Right? Rabbi Akiva encourages Bar Kokhba to do it. So, but laughter is a form of resistance. I'm unfazed. That's the best you can do. Right? I think that that's, and so for the rabbis, that's a source of comfort. Wow, that looks fun. I want to laugh instead of crying. Because crying is an indication that I'm in a place of brokenness. And Rabbi Akiva is clearly not in a place of brokenness. Did you? It shows what? Right. Yes. I
like, look at me.
Yes.
So I can have a baby without.
Yes.
Why are you pulling my leg? And same thing, I mean,
Right.
Like,
yes. Well, I think that he's that the laughter here is a sense that the world as it appears is not as it really is. And so what he's laughing at is the fact that I think that he's laughing at the absurdity of that reading of reality, of that experience of reality. Okay, so I promised to end with Ge'ula, and I've got about 5 minutes, so we need to get to redemption quickly. So we're joining the Talmud in Masechet Brachot. It's text number 5. And there's a machloket, there's a disagreement taking place, which we're not going to go into the nitty-gritty of the disagreement. We'll just hear it. And then I'm going to say something about how I understand Geula, and then we can have time for a couple more comments or questions. So Amar Mar, Korek Kriyat Shema U'mitpalel. Right, so you're supposed to say Kriyat Shema and then say the Tefillah, the Tefillah 18. Mesayelei l'Rabbi Yochanan, de'amar Rabbi Yochanan, Ezu ben ha'olam haba, ze ha'somech Geula l'Tefillah, של ערבית. רבי יהושע בן לוי אומר תפילות באמצע תקנום. So Rabbi Yochanan says the person who is ben ha'olam haba, the person who will be is deserving of being, will merit being in the world to come, is the person who somech geula letfila, who juxtaposes geula, redemption, to tefillah. And Rabbi Yochanan says that you do that in Aravit, and Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi seems to indicate that he says the prayers were instituted to be recited between the two recitations of the Shema. I'm going to skip over. I'm skipping into the last three lines of the page. De Rabbi Yochanan Savar Geula Meortana Mihave Ela Geula Mealiata Lo Havia Ela Ad Safra. De Rabbi Yoshua Ben Levi Savar Kevan De Lo Havia Ela Mit Safra Lo Havia Geula Mealiata. So Rabbi Yochanan thinks that redemption occurred in the evening as well. However, the full-fledged redemption was only in the morning. Since the redemption began in the evening, it's appropriate to juxtapose the blessing of redemption to the daily evening prayer. Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi, on the other hand, holds, since full-fledged redemption only occurred in the morning, and the redemption of the previous evening was not a full-fledged redemption, there's no need to juxtapose the blessing of redemption to the evening prayer. So the machloket is what. The machloket between Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi and Rabbi Yochanan is, do I say Geula in the evening as well? Everyone says I say it in the morning. I say Kriyat Shema, and then I mention Geula before I say Tefillah, before I say the Tefillah 18. And the machloket, which we won't get into, but I just have to note since it's there, between Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi and Rabbi Yochanan is, do I also say it in the evening? Was there redemption in the evening? So my chavruta and I, Joel Levy, so this is our understanding of this text. You know, and if you're blessed with the chavruta, at some point, you know, you start to lose who said what. So I'm saying this is our understanding of the text. Why is it that we are required? It's a very interesting, the Gemara, you know, as the Gemara often does, all it says is, right, you're supposed to lismoch geula letfilah. It doesn't say why. That's the interesting question, actually. It leaves the interesting question, right? It's only, do you say it in the evening or just during the daytime? Why? Why am I doing this? That's the interesting question. And they leave that unstated. So here's our best take. The reason that you have to do lismoch geula letfilah is because in order to pray for something, you have to have experienced redemption in your life. In order to pray for, what is the moment of prayer? The moment of prayer is, you know, as Michael Walzer says it about social criticism, but I think that's what actually happens in prayer as well, is we place ourselves between our existent reality and some reality that we are aspiring to. That's what I think the moment of prayer is, fundamentally. And so when Rabbi Yochanan, when the Gemara says, Tzarich lismoch geula letfilah, when you have to say geula just before you say prayer, the prayer, I think that what it's saying is you have, in order to do that, in order to pray effectively, in order to be able to open up yourself into that possibility, you have to have experienced geula. You have to have experienced redemption. Now the geula that the Chachamim talk about is the geula of Mitzrayim, the redemption from Egypt. So we have to, I mean, this is, you know, a guide for prayer, but that's not what I'm doing right now. We have to be able, in order to pray, to have little geulot, moments that were redemptive in our lives, which then form the basis of our ability to prayer, our ability to pray. Now, I've done that whole thing without saying what redemption is. I hope you noticed. Now the rabbis point to redemption as Yitziat Mitzrayim. And I think that the reason that they do that, and this is my best take on it, even though I'm not happy with it, is that it's an event that you say, that was totally good. It's always going to be b'diavad, it's always going to be something you're looking back upon, it's not at the moment. And it's when you construct or reconstruct what happened to you, you say it was totally good. Yitziat Mitzrayim was totally good. Leaving Egypt was totally good. When Bnei Israel said in the desert, you know, we miss the Kishuim and the Avatichim. We wish we were back in Egypt. We know that they were screwed up. We know that they were impaired. They hadn't reached their highest selves. Why do we know that? Because they were longing for slavery. They were longing for Egypt. The exit from Egypt, as scary as it was at that moment, was good. Irredeemably, irrevocably, unspeakably good. We cannot put it in any other category. That, I think, that's my working definition for right now of redemption. So the question is, I think, going back to the whole arc of the class, is there something, what are those things in our lives, personal or collective, that we can say are totally, totally good? There's no question about it. No question about it. And that will be the mirror image of Chulban. It will be something that we can say, that was good.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.